Upcoming Legal Affairs Committee meeting together. It's 8:07. Today is March 20th. Present today we have Co-Chairman Representative Morgan, Representative Guest, Representative Kula, Representative Scalzi, and myself, Co-Chairman Meyer. The items we hope to take up today are House Bill 135. That's a continuation from last Thursday, and we'll hope to start on House Bill 145 and then House Bill 20. So let's go back to House Bill 135, and joining us is Representative Murkowski. Representative Guest, if you could maybe bring us up to speed, up to date on where we're at on that bill, please.
Okay. The committee's request after the last hearing was to put in language, we passed a conceptual amendment, put in language to ensure that actual notice was given to the property owner and that appropriate corrective action was considered in the ordinance. In front of you is an amendment that was worked out between my office, TAM, and Assemblyman Heshey. So if you would want to review that, everyone seems to be in agreement, at least those three parties of this amendment so far.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Guest? Any other discussion? Representative Murkowski, you look
I'm just making sure that I'm reading this. The warning, and I appreciate the fact that we don't want to be too specific so that we've got enough flexibility that the municipalities can structure this the way that they need it. So all we're saying is you've got to have actual notice. We don't care how it's delivered, just so long as it's actual. And a warning. And then we're leaving it up to the municipalities to define what appropriate corrective action can be.
Correct.
And we're not defining what promptly taken is. That's up to them as well.
That is up to them as well.
All right.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions or discussions? Not the chair. Go ahead, Representative McCallum.
Does this address your concern, Beth, about the eviction?
Through the chair, it probably goes further than that because it would probably allow even things less than actual eviction. You know, maybe you just got somebody that's deaf and doesn't realize how loud their music is. I don't know, but it would. It seems to. I can't imagine a situation where if the person's in eviction, you know, that wouldn't be enough to take a landlord out of the problem.
Have we introduced this amendment?
That's the conceptual amendment. So
okay.
We're ready to pass the bill with the amendment. If somebody wants to make that motion.
Well, Mr. Chair, given the now viewing the conceptual amendment that is actually in hard copy in front of us, I would move that we move CS for House Bill Number 135 as amended, with the probably zero fiscal notes attached in individual recommendations.
Okay. Is there any objections? Seeing none, that will be done. Actually, yes. Where do you go next? We'll take a brief at ease as we change.
10, 8, 13. We've got House Bill Number 145. By request of the governor, we have Jim Baldwin, Department of Law.
Thank you, Chairman Morgan. My name for the record is Jim Baldwin. I'm with the Attorney General's Office. I thank the committee for hearing our bill this morning, House Bill 145. This bill was before the committee in the 21st legislature, this very committee, in the 21st legislature in the form of House Bill 425. It did not pass during that legislature, not for substantial reasons or substantive reasons in the bill. Simply, it was in the process too late, so unfortunately, it was not passed. This bill is a product of our efforts in prosecuting jointly with several municipalities in the state a claim that we have against a major financial institution. While this bill may not aid that litigation, it came to light that we need something like this to update our laws to give us better tools in enforcing the civil rights and remedies of municipal and state government when there has been a misrepresentation or a false or fraudulent claim presented against the state. We have basically in our law now a fairly skeletal statute that dates basically from territorial days in AS 3710090, which basically provides a right of action by the state or a municipality if money has been falsely paid or illegally diverted. And there are also provisions in there for the state taking over the prosecution on behalf of municipalities. And generally, it's been little exercised, if at all, since statehood days. And we believe that it's necessary at this time to update our law to have our statutes read similar to what other states have done by enacting a more detailed false claims statutes. And for a model, we have selected what has been used in the state of California. And that's what you see in basically the body of this bill. I believe why the bill was referred here is because of the provisions of it which relate to the cooperation between state and municipal governments when there may be claims which have both state and municipal involvement. And that's, I can tell you what our experience has been with our prosecution of our claim against the Bank of America. Our cooperation has been extremely good with the municipalities, but we had to go through a rather involved process of arriving at an agreement for how we were going to conduct ourselves and how we were going to finance our activities. This bill would resolve some of that as to deciding who goes first and what happens if somebody, one of the governments, doesn't want to go first. How does the other government step in and take responsibility, and how does that all operate? One of the greatest advantages of the bill, the reason why we would like to have it from the Department of Law's perspective, is that it provides a fairly potent remedy from a civil context, in that it would impose treble damages potentially against a wrongdoer. And it would also establish easy methods of proof following a criminal prosecution for fraud or misrepresentation. And those, I think, are modern improvements to the law, which our statute lacks because of its brevity, and I think would improve our law to a great extent. I think those are probably issues that will be resolved in another committee, but as far as I know, there have been no questions raised by the municipalities about the provisions which touch upon their powers or their activities in this bill, and would ask the committee to favorably pass it on to the next committee if that's and that's what you wish to do. If you have any questions, I'm
listening for Jim. Representative Ms. McCluskey.
Thank you. Mr. Baldwin, I understand that the meat of this is going to be resolved in judiciary, and I remember hearing in judiciary last year. So for the purposes of this meeting, though, you mentioned that it's the interaction between the state and the municipality in terms of who goes first. There's a provision in subsection C on page 5 that talks about the sharing, essentially the sharing of the cost. The share of each is determined according to the proportion of the money or property of each involved to the total money or property involved in the action. Realistically, how readily can you determine that? I mean, is that an issue where if there's some compensation coming back to the municipality or the city, do we fight and squabble over who gets what?
potentially, that can be a problem. I can tell you what we did in the Bank of America case is that going in, we had an agreement to try to determine what the in that case it involved bonds that were issued by the various governments, and what we established a formula based on the amount of debt service each entity was responsible for paying on the bonds that were involved, and so the costs are shared on a percentage of debt service basis compared to the whole, and that's kind of what we're getting at here with this kind of provision. If there's some logical way to arrive at that share, then this would be the avenue to getting there. Going in, I agree with you in the beginning, it's hard to tell what the total amount is involved going in, but I guess it could be done after the fact, too. There could be adjustments at the end to make the record straight.
But according to this language, unless you agree otherwise, the share is going to be this way according to the proportion, but determining that proportion can be probably problematic at some point in time.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, that what that does is it forces you to try to agree otherwise so that you, going in, you remove the dispute.
You would anticipate that you would do that in advance. I mean, when you decide who's going to go first, whether it's the municipality or the state, at that point in time, you would enter into some kind of an arrangement or agreement with regards to the cost?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think that's right. It seems to be, if there's enough at stake, there's usually a way to find an agreement.
No questions for Kim Baldwin? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody in the audience for the testifying? 145? Nothing in teleconference? If not, what's the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, I heard this bill twice last year, both in CNRA and in Judiciary, and I believe that this bill is probably the same as we saw last year. I still have some questions about it because I can't remember what we did last year, but for instance, there's some question in my mind as to what constitutes a reasonable time after they discover the falsity of the claim, and specific technical issues or issues that I think need to be resolved in the Judiciary Committee. I don't think it's worth the committee's time to go into those issues here, but I wouldn't have any hardship moving the bill out to Judiciary where it's more appropriately reviewed, knowing that they will do a fine job in figuring it out there.
What's the wish of the committee?
Representative Lugman, this is for Representative Rakowski. So you don't recall any concerns from last year or the previous times that you reviewed this?
Well, on page 2, subsection 2, this sets out the instances when a person is going to be civilly liable if they commit any of these acts. And then under subsection 8, we state that you're a beneficiary of an inadvertent submission of a false claim to the state, subsequently discover the falsity, you fail to disclose it within a reasonable time after the discovery of the false claim. It seems to me that there was an issue last year. Well, what constitutes a reasonable amount of time? The other one that I recall having the other section that it seems to me stood out a little bit was on page 3. This would be section C, subsection 3. In order to get a reduction or a waiver to the treble damages, the individual had to have cooperated and given all the information, no criminal prosecution had started, and the person didn't have actual knowledge of the existence of an investigation. There were just some things that I think were raised in committee and said, oh, well, what happened if you did all these things, but you knew that there was an investigation probably going to start, would you not be eligible for the reduced civil penalties? So I think that the committee can certainly find all the points of discussion. Seemed to me that it was a pretty reasonable bill.
Here's a question on the, I guess this goes to somebody who may file a false property tax form or something. I mean, is this any type of contract with the municipality?
Again, for the record, my name is Jim Baldwin. There are certain kinds of things that are exempted from the Act. First of all, if there's a single claim that can't be aggregated with other claims that's worth under $500, it's not subject to this Act. So we're not trying to bring in the small type claim. We're trying to get larger claims. And there are certain other provisions that are exempt. If they, in state law, they have an established statutory means for prosecuting false claims. Permanence on dividends are excluded. The employment claims are excluded. And under Title 43, the Revenue and Taxation Code. So these are state statutes where they're being exempted. So that's more comments.
I have a question.
Co-Chair Meyer.
Representative Scalzi, I was thinking along the same lines when I first read this bill. I thought it was to people who falsified their permanent fund application or their taxes or even maybe the senior citizen property exemption program. But you're saying those would be exempt from this particular law?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, while the permanent fund dividend is specifically exempted, if it's not specifically exempted, it could be prosecuted under this law. And so anything everything that is prosecuted under any civil penalty that's prosecuted under AS 43, which is our revenue and taxation code, would be exempt. Public assistance, AS 4725, is exempt because they have a statutory scheme there that we did not want to disturb. AS 4727, the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, or ATAP, it's exempted as well. And 2330, which is workman's comp, and 2320, which is the Employment Security Act, they all have statutes that punish people who make false claims. And we did not want to change that, the statutory scheme there.
Good. Thank you.
Question for Jim? No comment? Representative Pinkowski?
Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill number 145 to Judiciary for a greater and more in-depth review with individual recommendations in the zero fiscal note.
You hear the motion. Is there any objection? Hearing none, 145 is moved and community reasonable period. We believe while we sign the affairs committee back to order at 8:30. At this time we'll hear House Bill number 20. We have the prime sponsor here, Representative Moses, and his staffer, Ken. Welcome.
I'm Representative Moses, sponsor of House Bill 20. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for taking up this motherhood bill. I'm sure your committee members will love it. It'll go a long ways towards solving our long-range physical plan. I introduced this several years ago through help replace the municipal sharing revenue that we've cut to bare bones. It'll have very little effect on the size of your dividend. It'll go a long ways to eliminate the scrutiny by IRS to tax the fund. I think that's still a possibility. I think it's just a matter of time to there should be a couple minor amendments, the effective date, and Tim, my staff member, will speak to those. In eliminating most of the revenue sharing, we in effect have imposed taxes on our local governments. The money has to come from someplace. So I feel strongly that we ought to replace the revenue sharing through this method. It's limited to the amount of the surplus earnings. I feel that we should double this or provide for another $150 per dividend recipient, but have it not tied to any one particular service. I feel local government, that how the money is to be spent should be decided on a local level. With that, I'll try and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Representative Moses, my understanding, in the bill itself, it's you're calculating it at $150 per dividend, but this sheet that we just got is $250. Are you kind of running two different proposals up the pole here? Or?
Well, like I just said, I feel it should be another $150 added.
Okay.
I think the municipal league will speak to the $250 on.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know. Is this from them then? Okay. So right now your bill is just $150. And then, if I may, Mr. Chair, as I understand how this Public Safety Foundation program would work, you've got a set amount for instance, road maintenance, $2,000 for each mile of road. But within each of these components, you've got a provision that says that the municipality can use for education purposes an amount not exceeding 55% of the entitlement. Why did you choose to treat education that way?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tim Benintendi, staff to Representative Moses, Representative Murkowski. That, in fact, I guess what I'll say is the bill as introduced, as you have before you, is kind of an evolutionary product of the system in the 21st legislature. You folks heard this bill last year. In that process, some communities wanted to provide, they wanted to have an allocation for education purposes that they would determine. So that was the mechanism employed or structured to accommodate that. So under that provision, a community that receives funds can allocate up to 55% of their entitlement and use it for education purposes.
Was there any magic to the 55%?
I don't personally know how the 55% came up. That amendment came on the Senate side last year. Senator Tim Kelly worked the bill in the Senate last year, and that provision actually surfaced on that side, so I can't tell you exactly why that number was picked.
Representative, any more questions, Representative Murkowski?
No, go ahead.
Representative Gist?
I'm going to make a comment that we might want to check with education. It might have to do with the impact date and the equity issue that we have to stay within that range for federal dollars, but I'm more than willing to look into that and see and find out why.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Moses, for the presentation. You mentioned one point about how this would assist in the IRS scrutiny. Could you explain that?
Well, that's never been determined whether it's taxable or not. I think eventually it could happen that IRS, if we don't use it for some public purpose, it could eventually be taxed, the profits.
And that's where this would benefit it because it's going to a public purpose.
That's correct.
I understand. Thank you.
Any more questions for Representative Murkowski?
The choice of the word entitlement for the program, entitlement is kind of one of those bad words for Republicans, you know. We don't like to set up entitlement programs. If in, you know, I recognize that we have individuals from the permanent fund here with us this morning, and we wouldn't want to suggest that anything bad could ever happen to that permanent fund. But if we enshrine it in statute as this entitlement program, do you think we get ourselves locked in a bad way at any point?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murkowski, that language actually came from the Public Safety Foundation language. This is a program that was in existence in the 80s and apparently real popular and successful. And when the bill was drafted, I think they just acquired the language and entitlement was used. That, again, is nothing that's probably got a specific history to it. It could be changed, I suppose, without affecting the program.
Representative McConkey?
Yes. Could you address a little bit of the genesis of that program then? I mean, it was back in the 80s. Was around for how long?
I'm not sure. I would say about 10 years, and it was before my time here. And I have to claim ignorance in any detail, but possibly the AML can address that one if they testify. So there is a good history there. I know that much.
And I had one more question, Mr. Chair, and this was with regard to how the money should be paid out to unincorporated communities, and I'm assuming this is a situation where you've got Native Village Councils, but the language was somewhat confusing in terms of who you pay the money out to. The department shall pay the money under the entitlement to the entity that the department finds most qualified to receive and spend the money. And then it goes on to say that no monies can be paid out to a Native Village Council unless the council waives immunity for suit. How would you handle these very tiny little unincorporated communities in terms of the payment? If there is a disagreement as to who should get the money, we don't want to be squabbling over $10,000.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murkowski, the bill provides for the Department of Law in concert with the Commerce and Economic Department to determine who would be the receiving entity. There would only be one per community, and it could be a tribal council or some such like that. And it is true they would have to waive, their immunity. But that there is a mechanism for determining who would be the receiving entity. And so I guess the discussions or arguments would be when the Department of Law and the Department of Community and Economic Development would hash that out. I don't envision there'd be many of those at all, because there's a real history of, you know, these programs going to non-municipal entities.
That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
I probably want to wait a little bit to the municipal league, but I'll just throw this one out now in case you want to comment. In the municipal assistance and revenue sharing, there's a formula that was based on, you know, partially what the communities pay or what they tax themselves. And here you have a, for capital projects, I see that there's a, you know, a 30% match for communities that pay, or for grants over $5,000, and then there's a 15% asked for under $5,000. And I just was curious as to why it wasn't a considered flat all the way from no matter what the grant is. Would this encourage more low grants to be requested? No, that's on page 12.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, I think that refers to population figures, not dollars worth of grant money.
I'm sorry, yes, I stated it wrong, of a population figures. Regardless, it's based on a formula. The reason for that is, I suppose, that the smaller villages don't have the tax base. Is that what you thought is
correct?
Okay.
For the record, could we mention your name and who you represent, just for the secretary taking the notes later?
Yes, sir.
Make it easier
it's
for
it's Tim Benintendi, and I work for Representative Moses.
That's all I have. Thank you.
If I may follow up on that point, there's a provision in the bill that allows some of this money to be used as a community match for capital projects, both under the municipal capital matching grant program and the unincorporated community matching grant program. A little. That's an option they have to use these funds.
And this, just a follow-up, this is the only provision in here that has any type of municipal payment. Otherwise, everything is set up on a what your population is, $150 per person. Doesn't matter what your taxing structure is or anything like that. And I guess that's where we deviate from the current system we have, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions for
I apologize. I'm a little confused on one part. Maybe you can clarify it for me, of where cities fall into this. And I got tipped off on it when I, on the healthcare section, since we have hospital facilities that are not in municipalities. I guess I was thinking of a Bethel, second-class city, I believe it's a second-class city. And kind of how that would,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guest, if I understand the question correctly, the provisions are all in Section 7, and the beginning of that section, page 5, delineates eligibility for municipalities. Did that answer your question, I hope?
It's me. Thank you. Just back to the chair. Well, my confusion that I was sharing was maybe you could just lead us through it. So you've got cities like Bethel have a hospital. How do they get their money out of this?
Okay. Let's see.
They're not a municipality. They're cities, or are they?
They are
municipalities. Well, let's pick one that isn't. Do we or are there okay. any? Do we have an example? I see.
Well, on page 9, they provide for three different circumstances. I guess there's first of all, whether it's a community-owned facility or whether it's a nonprofit,
yeah.
And then whether there's a size differentiation, whether it's 10 beds or more, 10 beds or less. There's a per bed fee, a per bed entitlement, a per hospital entitlement, or just a flat $9,000, for example, on line 11. Four hospitals with less than 10 beds.
For for a municipality.
Mm-hmm. But then it goes on, let's see. It provides for health facilities, health clinics, for example, farther down in, let's say, that's about line 20, 21, 22 through 23, I guess. And then line 24, it delineates 360 per bed in a health facility, not officially a hospital, an institution not set up as a hospital.
And this may be answered by the AML. So do we have any hospitals that would somehow not be covered by this, or are they all in municipalities, or are they all nonprofits?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
Any more questions for Representative Moses or Ken?
Rick Hansen from the City Council of Dutch Harbor.
Good morning, Co-Chair Morgan, Co-Chair Meyer, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm Greg Hansen from the City of Unalaska, testifying in favor of House Bill 20. I'm here to testify as a City Council member with 7.5 years' experience. And over the period of that time, I've been following the changes in municipal funding. And while the City of Unalaska feels that developing a fiscal plan is imperative, this morning I'd like to limit my comments to the area of health and public safety. I have over 13 years' experience with the Unalaska Volunteer Fire and EMS departments, so this is an area that's near and dear to my heart. Unalaska has been fortunate enough over the years, with our own tax revenues, not to have to cut our services. But we understand and are familiar with the fact that this has not been true of many outlying communities, which due to budget cuts are operating with old or insufficient equipment and a lack of training to carry out their mandated services. I also speak to you as a recent patient in our system, having suffered a heart attack in Unalaska 14 months ago on a January evening, and had it not been for our highly skilled clinic and EMS people, I probably would not be here today enjoying the privilege of testifying to you. I want every resident of this great state to have that level of care available to them, and this bill will help us work towards that goal. Thank you for the opportunity.
Any questions for Greg? Thank you. Next we have testifies Kevin Ricker from the AML. Kevin Ricker.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. And I apologize. We should have a little AML logo right down at the very bottom on this thing. It was passed out this morning, and it's in support of the bill, and it gets a little bit more to Representative Moses's concepts about expanding the applicability. First, we would like to thank Representative Moses, who's worked very hard on this, and also Majority Leader Jeanette James, who worked with Representative Moses to bring the bill pretty much to the place you see it today. There was a lot of work done last year on in the State Affairs Committee on the bill. I would also like to thank or recognize former Governor Walter Hickel, who came up with the concept of a dividend program for communities, and March 7th, Governor Jay Hammond wrote an editorial in the Anchorage Daily News supporting the concept as part of the solution to the state's financial problems. Also, in the little packet that was placed on your desk this morning, not to look at it now, but there's also a letter of support from the Anchorage Economic Development Council, because this is a broadly supported concept. We have other organizations that supported the program last year, and we're working again with them to talk about the same situation this year. And real briefly, we think the two key reasons why this bill could be very acceptable to Alaskans is, number one, it's another permanent fund dividend, essentially. It goes to communities. It bypasses the IRS. Under the current situation, if things continue as they are now, local taxes will increase. You'll get your dividend as an Alaskan. The IRS, if you're paying taxes, might take as much as 30% of your dividend, and it would go to Washington, D.C., and then taxes will still go up, and you'll pay more local taxes out of your dividend. This kind of concept takes money and puts it directly into the services that we absolutely know people want to see, so you're bypassing the IRS, literally keeping millions of dollars in the state that otherwise would go to Washington. Not that that's a bad thing necessarily, but it would be a distinct advantage for Alaska. And as Representative Moses said, this also unquestionably increases the public purpose of the permanent fund. And Jim Kelly from the permanent fund is here today. He probably has more direct information on the legal work that the permanent fund is done in that area. The I wanted to mention, as far as why we think this would be a very acceptable concept for Alaskans, is that during the tax cap election, that basically went from Alaskans with an opportunity to cut or cap their property taxes, and they, in vast numbers, decided not to do that. And we feel it wasn't because they like taxes in particular, but they very strongly support the purposes that taxes are used for in their communities: education, roads, police, fire, EMS services. We think unquestionably that the huge outpouring of support to defeat the tax cap was based on people really wanting good schools, really wanting good health services, as Greg has mentioned, and so on. And so this provides a more effective way to support those services in each one of the communities. Just as an example, I think Governor Hammond is not known as somebody who's lightly talked about using permanent fund earnings, and I think his support of this concept is real key. And also last year, and Representative James can tell you about this herself, but she did a constituent survey in North Pole and Salcha and said, we would like to use part of the earnings of the permanent fund in this way to support these particular services. And she did sit me down and read the responses. And interestingly enough, the overwhelming majority of people in Salcha and North Pole thought that this sounded like a pretty good idea. Our feeling why they thought that sounded like a good idea is because this bill says how the money is going to be used. It isn't sort of generally to support government, which people, I think, would rightfully have questions about. It does particular things to be supported in to support particular services that we know the public thinks are very high priorities. So that's my quick presentation. And then I wanted to respond to some of the questions. Representative Murkowski had had a question about the 55% entitlement for schools. That was generated more as a result of second-class boroughs, and specifically the Fairbanks North Star borough had a concern. Under this program, the problem that a borough with lots of service areas has is the money would go into roads and fire, which is largely service area provided, and there wouldn't be a good way to provide general tax relief or general money for services in the community. And in a place like Fairbanks or Kenai, most of the money that goes to revenue sharing right now goes into the schools. And so the 55% was there to approximate the amount of money that now goes into schools from revenue sharing, so it wouldn't cause an increase in taxes locally. One thing I might mention, though, again, in the concept of expanding the program, if a larger dividend were a community, if a larger community dividend were generated, you could create a separate category for schools, which is one of the under the $250 community dividend option. We have that listed on the second page, and you could essentially create a $26 or $27 million pot specifically for contribution to schools, and then you wouldn't have to have a percentage of the other funds that would be allocated to the other services, but it could be more generally service provision and tax relief and extremely straightforward as to how the money is allocated. And again, Representative Murkowski, the word entitlements is of no importance, and so that could be changed easily. But the history of revenue sharing is kind of interesting, and we've got a little paper we could provide to you on the entire history of the program. But it started out in 1972 very much like the program that you have in front of you in House Bill 20. It was providing specific money for fire protection, specific money for police, specific money for planning, specific money for roads. Back in the 80s, when the oil money started coming in, people said, geez, that's sort of complex. Maybe we ought to just give municipalities a big chunk of money because we trust them. And that really worked the first year, and then the first couple years. And then after that, when anybody, whether it would be an assembly or a legislature, sits down and you've got to make a cut somewhere. And if you make a cut on something that's not revenue sharing, it hurts because it might be reducing maintenance in DOT, or it might be doing reducing the services provided by the by another department. But then you've got this big pot, and it's got a whole bunch of money into it, and you don't really know where it goes because you're just giving it to municipalities, and you can't really defend it because you don't have a lot of data or information on how it's used. So that becomes an easier thing to justify reductions. And there's two revenue sharing programs that, that we've looked at. One's the federal government, which had revenue sharing that essentially the same thing happened to it. It was a big pot, and it just kept getting reduced year after year because it was just going to somebody and you couldn't prove what was happening to the funds. And then on the state level, revenue sharing as a general block grant has been reduced by about 80% over the past 15 years. So we think that in the long term, number one, that, that it's very difficult for a governing body to deal with, the legislature in this case. And on the other hand, you can't really create a definite constituency for the program because there's no direct indication of where the money's going to be used. And so this program, even though it took our members a number of years to come to grips with this issue that revenue sharing as a block grant probably wasn't going to be something that would be a permanent fixture, they have, I believe, come to a realization that both in terms of public accountability, accountability to the legislature, that there needs to be some, well, accountability that goes along with the distribution of money. And then the Representative Murkowski's question on how the money is allocated to unincorporated communities. Number one, this bill tries to be real balanced. Even though we're not representing officially unincorporated communities, the amount of money going to unincorporated communities is still in the bill, and it's fairly substantial. And in addition to that, a fire department in an unincorporated community would still be eligible for uses the methodology of the municipal capital matching grants, which was a program approved under the Hickel administration to allocate capital matching money for capital projects to communities around the state. And that has an allocation for unincorporated communities and small communities. And as Representative Scalzi mentioned, this bill doesn't change that program. That program's the same one that was put into place under the Hickel administration and allocates money. And quite a bit of time was put into the formula there, so we didn't try to change it. And if you have specific questions on the unincorporated community question and how they determine those, Bill Ralston with the State Department of Commerce and Economic Development, or Community Economic Development, is in here in case you want to talk to him about that. And then hospitals, I believe that the hospitals cover all eligible hospitals in the state, whether they're in a municipality or not. And I think that was all the questions. And just this is something just to take away, but in this packet, there's information, and it's aimed specifically at a larger dividend. The information on the very back of the program from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation shows the impacts on the individual permanent fund dividends year by year. And the row down at the very bottom is the impact of a $250 dividend that Representative Moses referred to, or a little bit less than what he referred to. And the interesting thing is there is basically no impact on the projected dividends under any of those scenarios for the first 2 years. In the third year, the impact would be $10 under any one of the scenarios. So, for example, for 3 years, Alaskans could get $250 each year, total of $750 of tax relief for projected $10 decrease over 3 years in their permanent fund dividend, which if you take out your federal taxes, about $7. So about $7 for $750 in tax relief and services. And I don't think that any Alaskans would pass up that deal. Over a period of 11 years, the impact is very small. While the program itself would generate $150 million each year for tax relief and services. And then the very last thing I wanted to mention is simply we did a spreadsheet with the assistance of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and Representative Moses's bill is essentially the first columns, and then if you added in education and capital matching grants, that is the two last columns. So it gives you an idea of the kinds of allocations that would, under this program, that would go to communities. And, you know, this is all based on estimates, but it's the best estimates that we could put together. So, anyway, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the time, and we appreciate your consideration.
Questions for Kevin Ritchie, Representative Murkowski.
This last chart that you put together, everything makes sense in the first two columns, okay, and then the capital matching grants, we haven't really talked about that, but I'm not quite sure. You're just tacking on $200 per student, and then if it's in an REAA, what do you do?
Right, good question. This is just conjecture as to one way that you could allocate money for schools. This allocates about $27 million for schools, and we just simply multiply 200 times the number of students in the state and then allocated those by cities and by boroughs, which have school districts, and cities that have school districts. And then down at the very end of the presentation, it shows $3,161,000, and that's the $200 times the number of students in an REAAs. So because there's no municipal government running the school district, that money would, I guess, go back to the state, for example. I mean, we hadn't really thought that out, but this is just one possibility for an allocation.
Representative Myers.
Thank you. Kevin, thanks for your testimony, and you're very convincing. I'm still smarting, as maybe several of us are here, over the permanent fund vote, and I think we all took from that different interpretations, depending on who you talk to. There are some out there who believe that that all the permanent funds should come to the individuals themselves, and they will spend it much more wisely than government ever would or could. And albeit we're only impacting their dividend by $10 or whatever, and the benefits are, you know, in property tax reduction or whatever, or far outweigh that. That's still a hard sell to some of the people out there. Can you offer any advice on how to?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, or through the chair, this is obviously an interpretation of the vote, but. There were obviously weaknesses that people have talked about the September 14th vote. One of the weaknesses we think is significant is accountability. And whereas that vote said we're going to take a big chunk of money and put it into government, and then the question was, well, exactly what does that mean? And there wasn't really an answer that went out to the public. It was, well, it just goes to government, which is a pretty scary concept. And in essence, if you were walking down the street and somebody came up that you knew fairly well and they said, can I have $100? And almost anybody's first question would be, well, what do you want it for? And then you would evaluate whether you'd give it to them or not. But if they just said, well, we're going to do something good with it and it might help you, and don't worry about it, you might not be as motivated to give them the $100. We think that is a factor. But also, there needs to be some significant education done, and I think there's been a lot of confusing information that the public has received over the past number of years, and obviously the September 14th vote is one aspect of that, but we also like to think that the tax cap initiative vote is another aspect of that, and there is obviously a great deal of support in the public for good business decisions, maybe would be the best way to put it, whereas the public said, geez, if we cut taxes, which we would love, this is the impact. And so they actually had something to weigh, and they overwhelmingly said, we don't want that impact. We want to continue paying taxes. Even though we don't love taxes, we love the services. We think that if we can talk to the public reasonably about this, they say, well, we love the dividend, but we also love these services. And if this is a more efficient way to provide those services that, that benefits us in the long run, we'll support that. The other thing I wanted to mention is that Alaskans United Against the Cap is working with a number of other groups and trying to recreate itself as Alaskans United to do some, carry on some of those, that education work as a bottom-up process, grassroots, in other words. So.
Yeah, that'll help, Kevin, if we can get more education out there. And then your point is well taken, too. This particular bill gives specific areas on where the money's going to be spent, whereas during the votes, you're right, it's like, well, just trust us. And that's a little bit too much to ask, I think. And I do believe, certainly, if we could get Governor Hammond, you know, to help us sell this program. And I noticed somewhere in here he wrote a compass piece in support. So that would certainly help. So I think he's looked at as the father and protector of the movement. Okay, thank you, Kevin.
Any more questions for Kevin? Richie, Representative Scaldi.
Yeah, thank you. Just to touch on the Municipal League's position, has there been general support for this concept over the old revenue sharing and municipal assistance that currently exists?
Well, I think our policy statement says that if you wanted to just give municipalities $50 million in tax relief with no strings, that would be a good alternative that we would support. However, the Municipal League also will support this concept as a good one. So I'm trying to say that both of those would be acceptable. We think this one is the only one that's accountable and would garner that kind of long-term support that would be needed.
And does it address the fairness issue of, does Municipal League feel comfortable with the fairness issue of the revenue sharing aspect of it and the municipalities that tax themselves versus the ones that don't tax themselves?
That's a really good question. If there were a way of factoring that in too, I think that might be a real good option, but we couldn't figure out a way to do that. But what this bill does, which gets to the accountability and to a certain extent gets to the taxation issue, is you only get the $20 per person served for fire if you provide fire services. Not all communities do. Even though $20 per person isn't going to be enough to provide that fire service, it's an incentive to do so. So for fire, police, EMS, it's an incentive, and road maintenance, it's an incentive for municipalities to do more and rewarding, in essence, municipalities for doing more. So it's the same, maybe closer to the concept you're talking about.
Yeah. And one more follow-up, John, you touched on it. It says a borough or a city would be eligible for those funds, but if you had a fire service district, would they also be eligible, or would that go to a municipality?
If you were in the unorganized borough, it would clearly go to the organization if it wasn't part of an organized municipality. I believe the way the bill is written that even in place like Kenai, as a matter of fact, and there's, I think, several EMS organizations that aren't part of the city, and the money would still go to the borough, I believe, but it would presumably be allocated to those organizations.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions for Kevin? Representative Murkowski?
So, to follow up on Representative Scalzi's question in terms of what the AML's position is, Representative Moses' bill is $150 per head. You've given us information at $250 a head. Is that where you would rather see this go? Is it the higher per head dollar amount?
Through the chair, we would agree with the sponsor that a higher amount has still a very small impact on the dividend, but has more benefit to the people of the state. Municipal League is meeting next Thursday and Friday in Juneau with the legislative conference, and that's going to be one of our key questions, is putting this before the members and saying, is this what you want, or do you want to start out with a lower amount? So far, in talking to both our board and our Revenue and Finance Subcommittee, they're in support of the higher amount at this point. But we want to, I mean, but you need to keep, we need to keep educating our members and talking to them about the issue. Because what's really important is that every single community thinks this is a good idea. So we're trying to work on that aspect of it.
More questions for Kevin? Hearing none, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else out that hasn't signed the seat wishes to testify? Tim Kelly, PSD.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Kelly. I'm the Director of Communications for the Alaska Affirmative Fund Corporation. The position of the board, longstanding, is that they neither support nor oppose any proposals that relate to the use of fund earnings. Although, as you know, this year they did introduce on the House side House Joint Resolution 15, which would place a limit on the maximum payout and 5% of the market value of the fund. I was just here to answer any questions you might have had about the spreadsheet that we did for Representative Moses, and also, there's been a lot going on in the financial markets. One thing, as I was kind of looking through the materials, and I noticed on the piece that Kevin asked for, the $250 million or the $250 per ed municipal dividend. And it's a $90 difference in the dividend in 10 years. I had some calls from reporters yesterday. You know, the market's been down a bit lately. And it's actually looking like the market itself is going to cause the dividend this year to go down roughly $80. And so I would just counsel, when you look at these projection sheets, that that they're based on median expectations, and that you don't want to get too... you don't want to give too much credence to that they're actually going to turn out that way. There could be a lot more money for dividends or a lot less money for dividends than you show on these sheets, or for payout for any purpose. The market's going to have a much larger impact than something like this proposal here, for example. The dividends could be larger than you see here with this, with the municipal dividend program, as an example.
Any questions for Kim? Representative Mikulski.
Yeah, we all wish we could predict the market, and we'd be sitting here, we'd be retired. But the proposal that the Permanent Fund Board has endorsed and is selling at this point in time, that would limit the payout, how would that affect a program like this?
Well, the basic concept behind that proposal is three things, and it's designed to accomplish what the legislature has been accomplishing for the last 25 years, which is protecting the purchasing power of the fund so that it will be a permanent fund, setting up a system that will maximize the amount of income that the fund can produce year after year for this generation and for future generations, maximizing that amount of income. And then with those two sort of contradictory concepts, protecting the purchasing power and maximizing the payout, providing a means of providing the maximum amount of stability in the annual payout so that you don't have a situation where, like the state has with oil, where some years it's very high and some years it's very low and everybody gets into a big ruckus about it. So that's the concept of that plan. What it tells you and why this plan doesn't would have no negative impact on that proposal. That proposal says pay up, it is okay, it would be okay for the long-term vitality of the permanent fund to pay out 5% of its market value. The dividend plus the municipal dividend, as I read these numbers, come out to something like 4.5% of the market value, the average market value of the fund, a little less than 4.5%. That's the dividend plus the municipal dividend. You could actually, as Representative Moses pointed out, he thought it made sense to make it a $300 per person. Having analyzed the House Joint Resolution 15, are confident that you could pay out somewhere between $175 to $300 million more than you are right now and still have a permanent fund that was protected forever. and the $300 per head that he's talking about is in that range.
That would still be below the 5% payout then?
Yes.
In combination with the
with
permanent
the dividend.
Fund dividend?
Yes.
Would there be anything left over?
The dividend takes, right now, it takes about 4% of the market value of the fund, so there's 1% left. If you've got a $30 billion fund, which, by the way, we don't have today, but we'll get back up there again. If you had a $30 billion fund, 5% of that is $1.5 billion. The numbers on this sheet, the payout per person is somewhere around we're going to pay out about $1.1 this year, $1.1 billion. You're going to appropriate $1.1 billion for the per capita dividends. The $300 per person municipal dividend would take, something like take a couple of hundred dollars, depending on the year. Some years there would be, some years there wouldn't.
And then how would it work if the market really went south for an extended period of time and we had amended our constitution so that we provided no more than a 5% payout, and we had this program, the community dividend, in place, and we had, we've got our requirements, we pay out our dividend. What happens then?
Well, one of the advantages of that other proposal is that there is, because there's a constitutional limit on how much can be paid out, you no longer have to take the inflation-proofing money and move it from the earnings reserve account to principal. And this year, as this chart shows out, that's something like almost $700 million. Rather than moving that to the principal where it cannot be spent, it would stay in the earnings reserve account. In a situation that you're describing where for 2 or 3 or 4 years in a row you have negative earnings, eventually that earnings reserve account is going to go away, and then you don't have money for anything. So it's important to bulk up that earnings reserve account. For example, on June 30, there was about $6.5 billion in the earnings reserve account, and here it is now 9 months later. And that earnings reserve account, having paid out $1 billion and having suffered about a 6.5% negative return over those 9 months, that earnings reserve account is down to about $4 billion. That's what it'll look like at the end of this year. You have a couple more years like that, you can make that earnings reserve account go away, and then you've got a serious problem.
I guess I'm just trying to understand how serious the problem is if we have... if we've got in our statutes a municipal dividend program, and we've got in our constitution a cap on our payout, where the give is going to be. And I'm assuming that at some point your dividend to the people just goes away.
Well, I believe that House Bill 20 pays the municipal dividend after the per capita dividend.
Sure, okay.
And it also pays it after inflation proofing.
So if it did get to that point where it was real bad, this program would come after the dividend to the public?
Okay. It would, but putting a limit in place which allows you to hold on to that inflation-proofing money in the earnings reserve account where it is available for spending is probably going to turn out to be one of the key decisions facing the legislature, I think, in the future. That's going to make a big difference in the availability of money in the future, because you cannot spend principal by the Constitution.
More questions for Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody else from the audience want to testify? Sponsors can come back. Recap.
I am confident that this will be a major step in solving our physical problem. We do have a minor amendment. The effective date should be changed. And I'll have Tim speak to the other minor amendment.
Any
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Benintendi, staff to Representative Moses. Simply put, I overlooked when we reintroduced this bill, I overlooked correcting the same mistake I made last year. If the program were to be effective for FY02, the transfer would need to be made June 30th, 2001. The bill provides for the transfer from the earnings reserve to the what would be the new municipal dividend account, and that has to take place on June 30th for the program benefits to be effective from July 1st on. And the department has from July 1st to July 31st to make the distribution under these plans. So that's why we need to change the effective date. And if I might make one other point, to Representative Murkowski's question there, on page 14, line 10, the bill provides for, after inflation proofing and after payment of the dividend, the municipal dividend would equal the lesser of two amounts, one, $150 times the number of PFD recipients calculated from the previous year, or the balance in the account. So this program could shrink under, I suppose it would shrink somewhat commensurately if the income were down. And so there's a two-pronged scenario there. I just thought I'd point that out.
Yes, at this time, then, we need a motion to change the effective date. Amen.
So moved.
So moved by
To what date, Mr. Chairman? June
30th. June 30th.
2001.
And if I can just
go ahead, Representative Murkowski,
kind of speak to that. If we make it June 30, 2001, I'm just wondering, practically, whether we can implement something that quickly. Whether it would be more wise to hold off until 2002.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murkowski, I suppose that's just a value judgment. I think the department would be ready to go. This is a program that they're somewhat familiar with from the past, but that would just be up to the...
I'm thinking, you know, permanent fund applicant, because you're basing this number on the permanent fund, those who apply for permanent funds. That deadline is what, March 31st? Do you have to have your applications in?
Yes, ma'am, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murkowski, but it would use last year's figures, so
okay.
We've already got those.
All right, so
in
it's
fact,
not
that's
like...
What,
okay.
That's in large measure what generated the numbers on the Permanent Fund Corporation's handout. Which
okay.
Is,
so it's permanent funds from the year previous.
Any
discussion
on effective date? Representative Scalzi?
Yeah, just to follow up on Representative Murkowski's concerns, comments. You know, we are looking at making this a part of a long-term fiscal plan. And for practicality reasons, following the same line of thought, if there's an impetus to do this year without a large public review of a total package, I'm wondering, would we be under more pressure to pass this year versus, I mean, I'd feel more comfortable with a public review on it and doing it next year, is my thinking on this. But does that make any sense to you, or do you feel that this is a standalone measure that should go forward this year?
I think it's a standalone measure. I feel strongly that we should have capped the permanent fund in prior years. And this, in a small way, does put a slowdown or a cap on the dividend. And I think it's a standalone deal. We've really cut revenue, municipal revenue sharing to bare bones, which actually puts a property tax on our constituents. So indirectly, we have already taxed them, and this is a method to bring that back up to where it should be, and hopefully more.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we've got a motion on the floor to change effective date to June 30, 2001. Any objections? If not, the motion is passed. Thank you. Any more testimony? Anything you want to add?
Thank you,
Mr. Co-Chair Meyer?
Just a kind of a philosophical question, I guess, Representative Moses. If you could give me some history, this has been around a while, this municipal dividend plan. Is that correct? This isn't the first year you've brought this forward.
It's been several years, I think. Probably 4 years ago I first put it in.
What has been the opposition or resistance in the past to this bill?
I really don't know. I'm not privy to some of the decisions that are made by the majority.
Mr. Chairman, comments we've heard over, and this is the third legislature that this bill's been introduced in some fashion, in its current, some version of its current form. There is, you know, considerable stress in accessing the earnings reserve for the first time for a major program, but the program components are very popular, and they're, we've tried to keep this down to just the essential needs and what are considered essential government services. So, you know, there's, it could turn into a Christmas tree, I suppose. Last year it went through quite an evolutionary process, both in the House and Senate, and both versions wound up in the Finance Committees. We just couldn't get hearings in the Finance Committees last year. But there was never, as far as the program components, there was never any real negative commentary last year, officially in hearings or, you know, as we heard from people.
I guess I agree with Representative Scalzi to some extent in that maybe this should be part of a bigger overall fiscal plan, because this is certainly a very good idea, but it's just one small aspect of something bigger. But I know what you're going to say, Representative Moses. We've got to start, and you're right. We've got to start. So.
Well, more than that, I think we ought to roll up our sleeves and do a physical, long-range physical plan this session.
And what you're saying is that maybe this will get us jump-started a little bit.
I should hope so.
Very good. Thank you.
Any more questions for Representative Moses? If not, any closing remarks?
This and House Bill 10 would go a long ways to bring about a long-range physical plan.
Which one? House Bill 10?
Income tax.
Oh, that's yours. That's right.
Representative Mikulski?
Well, since we're into the comment period, I would just like to commend Representative Moses for once again bringing this forward. I think it's a good idea. It's been a good idea that's been out there for a long time, and I think that perhaps there hasn't been the political will to go into the earnings reserve arena, and probably understandably so. But timing is everything, and I'd like to think that we're getting a little bit closer to that point where something like House Bill 20 can get through the legislature. One of the reasons that I like it is that it does allow for that accountability, and as Kevin Ritchie said, when we got into that September 14th vote, we were essentially, many people felt that we were asking, the government was asking for a blank check. This isn't asking for a blank check. It is money going to the municipalities, to the local governments, for very specific purposes to provide essential services. And I don't think that there's any Alaskan out there that's going to say that roads and fire
and police protection and education aren't essential government services. And I think that if there's any way that we can get the public to agree that perhaps it is time to go into the earnings reserve, it is for specific purposes. And I hope that this is something that kind of gets us kick-started or jump-started, whatever the term was that you used, towards a long-range fiscal plan. This could be a component, but it may be a very key component in the sense that it frees up some general fund monies that we can put towards education funding or capital projects or what have you. I just hope that this year the bill gets a little bit further than it has in the past three legislative sessions. So, go Representative Moses.
I need your help.
Any more closing comments? If not, what's your wish for the committee? Representative Moses.
I'm blabbermouth today.
Go ahead.
I move that we move House Bill number 20 out of committee, recognizing that it goes next to state affairs, individual recommendations, and the attached, I guess there's just, you know, there's two fiscal notes, both zero fiscal notes. Oh, yes, House Bill 20 as amended.
Hear the motion. Is there any objections? Hearing none. Council number 20 has moved out of community reasonable. Thank you.
We have a meeting. Yes.